All right, here we are. We have a couple of things to do tonight that I think you're going to find a lot of fun and very entertaining. Among them, you see the video monitor back here. A lot of you may have heard that last night we were on the news. Well, we have for you a copy of that segment of the channel, local Channel 4 News. For those of you who live in New York and know Live at 5, Channel 2? In New York, it's Channel 4. Yeah, it's NBC. ABC? I'm really off the beam on this. In New York, this is very confusing. Wait a second. Yes, this is on tape. It's going in the archive, and I'm signing a no on the okay to copy. For those of you who have seen our permission forms, you know what I'm talking about. And for those who don't, I just spelled it out. So what am I explaining? In New York, we have a show called Live at 5 on one of the networks. Here in Nashville, they have a show called Live at 5 on one of the, whatever it is, we're not going to show you a transcript. No, we're not. We're going to show you a... You're going to see what the people have seen for the last 2 days in Nashville that have prompted so many phone calls to the Country Music Foundation that they are now hiring me on a part-time basis to do what I'm doing right now, which is get drunk and make a fool of myself in front of you all. Alan, do you have that? Is that queued up? Okay, here we go.
The Association for Recorded Sound Collections is holding their annual meeting at the Holiday Inn Vanderbilt through Saturday. Both private and professional collectors are attending and swapping information and stories about their favorite recordings.
We think it's important because it documents in a great many ways what entertainment is and information is relevant.
Now, if you're interested in attending any meeting, phone Danny Hatcher.
256-1639. Now, if Gerald Green would like to stand up and take a personal bow. Now, if time permits, we may run that whole thing again. It was ABC. Our president has asked me to remind you of this. We were on again tonight, not with the same segment, with a much longer one, with, I'm told, an interview with Milford? With Tim and with Milford. Terrific. We may have a copy of that someday. And if we do, and if it's possible to have it tomorrow, and there's no promise on this, we will run it between party records and gospel music, I guess. But if not, just as good. You want Milfard Fillmore? I'm going to risk this. Now, as most of you know, the Zerblises were kind enough last night to give me a book called How to Speak Southern. And I have promised to make a brief attempt in my introductions tonight to speak Southern. And I've written it out. She has been coaching me all through the banquet. And I'm... Southern Comfort. Virginia Gentleman of Southern Comfort. Actually, Maker's Mark is my brand. Yeah, no, thank you. I'm about to. I didn't say all night. Here I go. Bear with me, please. Yeah, we're getting Boston thrown in here from the boondocks. Now, in my time here, it has occurred to me that the quality of life here is really rather terrific, isn't it? I need some applause here, isn't it? I can't help that. Now, I promised you Southern, and I'm probably letting you down. But when I looked in my mirror this evening, when I saw a Yankee face, I can't help it. Now, this is a hard one here. I'm going to keep these remarks as brief as possible, as I'm sure you're tired of hearing me, and I still have a day to go. Now, public speaking often leaves me swimmer-headed. Swimmer-headed. These are all in the book. And your reception of everything this week has been much appreciated. Thank you. Now, it's a lot of work. And for a lot of people whom I'd like to thank, I'm going to thank right now. First of all, the man who you have met, talked to, seen, thanked several times, I hope, and several times again, I hope, by mail, if you have the chance in the next couple of days when you get home. I didn't write this part out. I'm supposed to be getting so into it, I could do it off the cuff. First off, off the floor, Mr. Danny Hatcher. Now, reclining on my left, Mr. Alan Stoker. Now, last but not least, the lady who has helped us coordinate so very well, not just for this week? I can't say week, but for months prior to this conference, Ms. Casey Cawthon. Now, as you look at us, if any of us looks mommicked up, it's only the effect of lots of very hard work, which I think you've seen this week. Now, I hope you've enjoyed this mess of food, none of it boiled. That's what it said in the book. Bald. Spelled with a W. Now, with this paragraph, I am plumb wore out of words. It has been fun, but I feel I'm cutting the fool up here, and there's still the business at hand of this evening's entertainment. I'm much obliged for your attention. See y'all in the morning. All right? No, I'm reverting here. Back to New York. Before I introduce tonight's speaker, I want to bring up here to the podium for just a brief moment, our president, Tim Brooks.
I can't really follow that, but some of you may know what I do for a living is evaluate new program for ideas for NBC, including sitcoms, and if Peter is available, I think I've found one. Have a good time this evening.
Drink first. I'm not sure I can drink and do this. Oh, yes. I have been handed a note to read. I'm back in my Southern. This is a kind of double tribute. I hope some of you will recognize the reference. Ich bin ein Rebel. Thank you, Elwood. Okay, back to me. I am going to make an introduction which is a little unusual, a little different. I am going to read you a prepared introduction which some of you may have read since it comes right out of our biographical sketches for the election. And then I'm going to digress a bit and talk a little bit about Milford Fargo on my own. You won't have to. Milford is a professor of music education at the Eastman School of Music at the University of Rochester in New York. He's listed in the International Who's Who in Music and the ASCAP Biographical Dictionary as a noted singer, conductor, composer, and teacher. A founding member of ARSC at the 1966 Syracuse Convention, he's been collecting popular vocal recordings for over 25 years and is recognized as the world's leading authority on Ada Jones, the first woman to become widely known through the phonograph. He is also the personal friend of several pioneer recording artists and has presented many sessions at the ARSC conventions. He will be the host of a new series in preparation for PBS Radio entitled Sounds Like Old Times. This refers really offhand to many programs at the ARSC conventions. I've been going to the ARSC conventions since the meeting in New York in, I think, 1969. Is that right? And it seems to me that Milford has been a part of the conventions for me, a major part, ever since that meeting in New York. A couple of years ago, you may remember we had a meeting in Chapel Hill, and I had been sick in the hospital with malaria and wasn't quite sure I could make the meeting and came down at the last minute without a reservation for a hotel. And I got, after much cajoling and crying and screaming over the telephone, a booking at the Tar Heels Motel, about which there was much hoot and holler when I arrived at the meeting. And when the goings-on at the motel were described to me in somewhat graphic detail, I panicked, and I don't panic very easily. But as there was no phone in my room, and a television I was told turned into a movie camera at midnight, and I was staying alone, I felt something needed to be done. And Milford very kindly offered me space in his room, for which I am eternally grateful and still alive. Over and above that, last year Milford was scheduled to speak at the convention in Syracuse. And I received a letter, I'm not even sure how long, several weeks before, which Milford had written to me, stating that because of certain health considerations, he was unable to attend. In point of fact, he was in the hospital. He'd had an operation. He'd had a heart attack while having the operation, and I think a second operation after that. In spite of this, he wrote me a letter, not just saying he couldn't come, but suggesting possible alternate speakers to take his place. I think Milford Fargo is an extraordinary man and an extraordinary asset to ARSC and to any institution or any group he intends to grace. It is my great pleasure and my privilege to introduce to you Milford Fargo.
That's a hard act to follow, too. I felt so far away from everybody, I thought I'd be like Helen Morgan and come on right on out.
Don't step back.
You light up my life. I can't tell you what a pleasure it is to be here. It was last April when I wrote you all that stuff, and you were meeting in May. But I now have a vein from my leg across my heart, and it's working really well. I should have done it years ago. I'd much rather be here than there. And so they gave me a rain check on this. And years ago, when Alec Wilder was chosen to be given an honorary doctorate at the University of Rochester, he said, well, I'll come and I'll attend if I don't have to say anything. He despite what some people think from his radio and television programs, hated anything public. His idea of going into a crowded room was to be in the back corner behind the drape. But when they finally coerced him to be on it, then he carried it off as if he was born to it and really loved it. But he hated every minute of it. And he said, if I don't have to speak, I will come. And they said, well, usually the recipients of honorary doctorates are the commencement speakers. And he said, oh, no. He said, let my music speak for me. which is what they did. And I would like to start this evening by letting his music speak a little for him. And Alan's going to compete. Just a second, Alan. Will you? All right. Alan's going to compete with Next Door as best as he can. I chose this opening piece for five reasons. One is, I think it's his most well-known, famous song. Two, it's the song that I first knew anything about Alec Wilder. And I was in junior high school at the time. And the first time I heard his name was this tune. The third reason is I have an anecdote that he told me after I became such friends with him 25 years ago. That's the third reason. The fourth reason is that this song was involved last month when he was inducted into the Hall of Fame, the Songwriters Hall of Fame in New York. Too bad they waited 2 years after he died, but that's life, isn't it? And fifth, it's really kind of a theme of Alex. He was a nomad, and he would come into town, and he was the kind of friend that you could break up a conversation with, and 6 months later when you saw him, he would just continue on the next sentence, and you knew what he was talking about, and he knew what you were talking about. And it's a great kind of friendship to have. He was never gone. And I said, when will you be back? And he said, oh, I'll be around.
I'll be around, no matter how you treat me now. I'll be around. Your latest love can never last, and when it's past,
Mills,
I'll be around when he goes. Goodbye again, and if you find a love like mine, just now and then, drop the line to say you're feeling fine, and when things go wrong, perhaps you'll see you're meant for me, so I'll be around when
these are all vocal imitations of instruments, including the bass. The Mills Brothers Decca recording, that was his first big hit. And he walked into the store in New York and asked to audition the record, took it in the listening room, listened to it, brought it out, broke it over his knee, broke it in several pieces, put it on the floor, crushed it under his feet, walked over and paid for it, and walked out. there's always a critic. He said, I worked damn hard on that tune. And he said, they not only changed the melody, they changed the harmony. They didn't keep my bass line. And he said, they had no right to ruin my song. And that was that. And he said, and the only reason it was popular, it was on the back of Paper Doll. but that's probably the most income he ever got was from I'll Be Around. He also was the only real gypsy I've ever known. He had no home. He had no possessions other than what went into two suitcases that he carried with him wherever he went. Well, there used to be a third one under the counter at the Algonquin, but it got the contents got kind of ugly, and they put it in the basement and was last seen swimming up the East River. But he, what wouldn't fit in these suitcases, he just left behind. And he loved to read. He bought books. He always had about three under his arm at once. And when he finished the books, if he couldn't talk the store into taking them back because they were only slightly used, and trading them in for others, is Scribner's the big store and bookstore in New York? Yeah, he would go. He actually did trade them once in a while for books. Because he'd buy them one day and read them overnight and bring them back the next day. Or he'd just give them to friends, or sometimes strangers. He thought this would be good for you, so he'd give you the book. He did the same with pieces he wrote. Most of the music he wrote was for friends, or he'd see a new artist and he'd say, oh, that kid really deserves a piece of his own, and he'd write him a piece. And then he would leave it with whomever he wrote it. And if anyone else says, whatever happened to that trumpet piece, he'd say, well, ask Frank, you know. And then you'd get a letter, can we have a copy of that? And most of his music was passed around by copies like that. He was never published, and he never made any money on it. But that's what he wanted to do, was write for people he liked. And once in a while, he had to do arrangements, like for Benny Goodman and Frank Sinatra and friends that... And Mitch Miller got him a lot of jobs. And he would keep his head above water with those. But when he would leave town, whatever didn't go in those two suitcases just got left behind. He rented a room by the day wherever he was. In New York, it was always the Algonquin. Not always the same room. I visited him there one time, and he was down on his hands and knees fixing a frayed lamp cord, and he says, I have fixed more damn rooms in this hotel. he said, they ought to give me a room free for all the repair work I've done. And everyone knew him on a first-name basis. He has written a wonderful book of the history of the Algonquin, which they wouldn't let him publish because they felt that some things he said weren't in good image of the hotel nowadays. It's among his effects, which... he's from Rochester. He was born in Rochester. His family was a banking family, and Alec was the black sheep because he was interested in music. He was identical twins when he was born. His brother died shortly after birth and is buried in Rochester. But Alec was a very independent person. He could be a thorny cream puff, because on the inside he was very tender. On the outside he could be also very tender, but also very scathing if you got in his way. He told me, he said, a third of my life I don't remember because it was under the influence of alcohol. And it was one of those times that he was punching Benny Goodman out on the street. And he and Harry... it'll come back. But he was a wonderful man in many respects. One thing that kept him company in his suitcases were bobble birds. You know, those little glass birds you put on the edge of a water glass, and those were his companions. The next piece speaks very highly of him too, and it's probably his second most famous tune. And the lyric isn't just a lyric with him. He really meant it. He hated living in a city. He he too much stone, too much telephone, too much exhaust, too much noise, and he loved to be out in the woods and in the country. Telephone would ring, and he'd say, "What are you doing this afternoon?" And I would pick up the car keys because I knew he wanted to go somewhere. And we'd drive out to Durand Eastman Park and go out walking in the trees. And one day he said, "I can't go in because I'll never come out." And when he wasn't writing, he was very depressed. When he was writing, he was on a high. And he got so depressed at times that people were seriously worried about what he would do. And so they tried to get him little jobs. Mitch Miller was great at this. You'll even find Alec writing the reindeer dance on Golden Records and things like that, because Mitch Miller was pulling him out of another deep woods. He loved to go walking on railroad tracks. And more than once, we jumped in the car and would go down to Avon, New York, which is south of Rochester, a very peaceful little community with a little square in the middle of town. And we'd get out and walk down the railroad tracks. Some narrow misses occasionally, but this lyric, "It's So Peaceful in the Country," is sung by one of his favorite singers and one of his real friends, Mildred Bailey. Those two songs, he wrote the lyrics as well as the music, and he seemed to be equal book. Some of us are after those of us who do have letters he did mail, and I said a sequel ought to be letters he did mail. because some of them are really terrific. He wrote me one after we did Children's Plea for Peace in Avon, which Vox recorded and released on Turnabout. And when he wrote the letters and never mailed, he mentioned everybody that had anything to do with Children's Plea for Peace, including the custodian who set up the stairs, chairs, except me. And people wrote to him and said, how come, you know, this is the guy who did the whole thing? And it suddenly struck him that he never thought of me as being, you know, involved in all of that, because it was so natural us to work together that it would be like mentioning himself, so he didn't mention me. And I understood that. And before my lawyers could sue, he wrote me the most gorgeous apologetic letter, a great longhand. He carried stationery with him constantly, and envelopes and stamps. And whenever he was sitting waiting for a plane, which was his main mode of travel since train transportation conked out on him, for which he never really forgave them, while he was waiting for all of these things, he'd write letters. And that's why the idea for the Letters I Never Mailed book. But he wrote me the greatest letter apologizing and saying, of course this couldn't have been done without me anymore than it could without him, blah, blah, blah. And when he offended someone inadvertently, he'd write him the next day. He would say, why isn't he speaking to me this morning? And they say, you don't remember? He said, I don't remember a third of my life. And he would say and do things that he would claim never to remember. I don't know if it was protective or real, but he was two different people. And when I first met him, he was drinking only black coffee, and which was true right up until the last couple of years when he was dying of lung cancer, and he just thought, what the hell, after that. And it helped kill some of the pain. I remember he told me once about being asked to work on this tune that eventually turned out to be Tenderly. And he was asked to be one of the lyricists, and when they got into using the word tenderly, he just refused and stomped out. And he said, I don't care how much I might need the money, that is the wrong accent on the wrong syllable, tenderly. And he said, if you're writing tenderloin, all right, but tenderly, no. And he just, he had very strong convictions about how you set words. And the Alec Wilder Alleluia, for example, would have taken two measures, not a whole piece. Or the Hallelujah chorus of Alexander Wilder would have just been once stated, and that's it. He said, I've said it, why say it over and over and over? You know, so he did not write melismatic music, he just said it. Tony Bennett was another great friend of Alec's, and Alec loved him, and Alec would worry about everybody. He'd sit in his, no wonder he was depressed. He worried about everyone else when they weren't worrying about them. He'd worry about Tony and his relations with his kids and his family. And he really liked Tony's performance of the third great song that people remember Alec Wilder for, While We're Young. Every day is
so blue the skies. Oh, sweet surprise. Signs before our
I'd like to be remembered for things like that. While he was at the Eastman School back in the early days of Howard Hanson, he didn't always get along any more then than he did later. And anything that students usually did to rankle the faculty, he was in the lead. And he wrote a musical at school that lambasted everything in sight. And he always had this wonderful, irreverent touch. He could turn any staid situation into a comedy, and also had a very tender touch. He loved, in addition to trains and the luxury of the old-fashioned train travel, children. The innocence and involvement of a young person, not babies. He didn't like babies. They weren't people yet. They were just, you know, they were potentials rather than realizations. But when they got to be like 7 to 9 years old on up, he just loved kids. And when the Alec Wilder Octet came into existence, in which Mitch Miller was the oboe player and the Carroll Boys and Frank, who was the harpsichord? I'll think of it. Walter Gross, yeah. And he was one of the first to use harpsichord in kind of a pop music situation. And he kind of got turned on to the harpsichord at Eastman in the old days when we were doing classical music. And he loved Bach and he loved counterpoint, but he really liked the sound of wind instruments. And he was one of the first to really put bass clarinet and bassoon and harpsichord and drums and flute and oboe together. And I chose this piece because it combines two loves of him, children and trains. And it's called When the Children Met the Train. And this is from the original Alec Wilder Octet. Little irreverence again. Thank you. little text painting there, yeah. People have tried to analyze his compositional styles, and I use the plural because he didn't have any prejudice about what he used. Some of people claim that there's a great French influence in the use of his harmonies and instrumentation. He's particularly known for woodwind quintets, although he's written brass quintets too. He's written band pieces, symphonic numbers. He's written operas, chamber operas, full-length operas. He's done film scores. He orchestrated the Grandma Moses television special. He's done Broadway shows, The Importance of Being Earnest. He did Sunday Excursion with Arnold Sundgaard. You name it, and he would do it. He arranged for Carol Bruce before she became Mama Carlson on WKRP. He arranged for Frank Parker. Matter of fact, he wrote a song called Parker's Lament. Terrible pun-filled thing by Bill Engvik. Bill Engvik was from the West Coast and spent quite a few years in the East, and he called it, what was it? His 15-year insult was living in the East, and he finally went back to the West Coast. Alec loved Frank Sinatra, and Frank loved him, and Alec used to worry about Frank and all of his family and problems. And he always claimed that Frank Jr. would have made a wonderful composer had he followed that bent. And during World War II, Frank Sinatra got interested in becoming a conductor. Doesn't everyone? And he decided that Alec's music would be the thing to conduct. And of course, Mitch Miller encouraged him to do this for Columbia. And I ran across an old V-disc on which they put a gun to Alec's head and made him greet the soldiers from World War II. And Alec said, oh, they had him on the rack and they wouldn't let him off until he said these words. And you can tell it from the way he's speaking. You can just see him there with the pistol between his eyes. But he did it. He was good. They told him it was for the war effort. And then Frank is conducting a piece called The Slow Dance, which was the Columbia Strings from the Columbia Orchestra, plus, I think, members of the Wilder Octet. At least Mitch is doing the oboe work here.
Hi, fellas. My name is Alec Wilder. Believe it or not, Frank Sinatra can do a lot more than sing. In fact, he conducted some music of mine, which you're about to hear. I know it's hard to believe, but I saw him do it. He's a great musician as well as a great guy. When he makes up his mind to do something, he does it. The best musicians in New York were brought together to make all this happen. They played the stuff so well, I can't figure out whether it's the music or the way they played it that makes me feel good. What do you think? Here goes on V-Disc.
This is Eddie Powell on the flute. when Marion McPartland was in town playing in Rochester at one of the clubs, she looked out one night and she said, "My God, there's Howard Hughes." And Alec was often mistaken for Howard Hughes in appearance. He was a tall, lean, angular, craggy guy, and what few pictures you saw of Howard Hughes, you'd swear that it was Alec, which both amused him and displeased him. He disliked being recognized as anybody. So he was a little amused that he would be put in that same category. And Marion soon found out that it wasn't Howard Hughes, because this disheveled man, who was always being driven out of the Eastman School main corridor by the security, because we had trouble with the downtown winos wandering in, and some kid would put his Stradivarius down and check his mailbox and turn around and his Strad was gone. It was soon turned into a bottle of Muscatel in a brown bag, you know. Yeah. That's when Jerry was there too. Giuseppe Verdi, yeah. But this funny-looking man slid a piece of manuscript paper up to Marion at the piano, and she looked it over, and it was called Jazz Waltz for a Friend. And he had written her a piano piece because he admired the way she played the piano. And that led to a whole series of little piano pieces that he wrote for Marion. It became kind of a love affair between the two of them. So whenever she played at the Round Towner down in Henrietta, we all went down and heard this Alec Wilder recital among the clinking of the glasses. And she made an album for Halcyon, and this next cut is called Lullaby for a Lady by Marion McPartland. That's another more intimate, tender side of Alec Wilder, who never ceased to kind of change and amaze you. One day I got a long-distance call from New York, and person to person at school, and they rounded me out of a classroom, and I came running in to see what it was, and the whole message I got on the line was and then click. And I knew it was Marion McPartland, because a couple of weeks before she had been in town playing at at the inn, and Alec and I, and she had to go out in the country. Alec was enamored with tree frogs, among other things. And he was just insane overhearing the peepers in the spring. And they sound, you know, the high ones sound like jingle bells. And then that particular night, we were out in God knows where, Bushnell's Basin, I think it was, and we were hearing these jingle bells, and all of a sudden there's this big rock, rock going along underneath, and there was one kind of frog that was going, and Marion McPartland just got hysterical. And I wanted to keep going. She says, no, you've got to stop. And she got out the cassette recorder and a cassette. And I sat there for 12 minutes listening to this peepers and, you know, and the only thing she would say to me for days was, she was going, and so 2 weeks later, this call from New York, and it just went, click. And so Marion was at it again. But Alec took that cassette, and that's one thing he kept with him for a long time. When he got really depressed, he'd sit and watch the bobblebirds and play the peepers. Yeah, so there were three particular pieces that Alec and I were associated with. I mentioned the Children's Plea for Peace. That came about in the late 50s, I guess. Lou Ozer, the photographer, freelance photographer, who did that wonderful black and white book on musicians. He'd been around the Eastman since practically it opened in 1922, always backstage with his camera, and he'd photographed all the artists that came through. And in he came to a rehearsal. I had 200 young children in an area-wide chorus called the Eastman Children's Chorus in the grades 5, 6, and 7. And I riding shotgun in the front, and my wife riding shotgun in the back. And they were terrific kids. And we were singing Up a Storm one day, and Louie walked in with Alec, and looking seedy as usual, he kind of sat down, and everyone ignored him. And afterwards, he came up, and he said, "You son of a bee." And I, "What? What did I do? What?" And he said, "You've got the secret." Whatever that meant, or whatever that was. So he said, "I've got to write a piece for these kids. They are driving me crazy." And I said, "So write." And he said, "What am I going to write?" I said, "You want to write the piece, write it. We'll do it." So he had a friend. The closest thing he ever got to being religious was to have a Catholic priest as a friend. And Father Henry Atwell was an extraordinary man also. And he was in this little village of Avon, south of Rochester. So Alec went down and said, "What are we going to write about?" And so it was at that time, happiness is, you know. So they said, "Let's ask the kids down in Avon to say, peace is." And so they did, and Alec chose some things. And between the boo-hooing, the tender cream puff coming to the fore, he chose some incredible words that these kids wrote, and decided that the only way to accompany these kids would be to ask Don Hunsberger to give me the Eastman Wind Ensemble so he could write for winds and children's chorus. And he said, "What are the ranges? What can I do?" So he wrote everything from unison to two-part to three-part to four-part, which gave me an interesting problem in logistics. Now you're singing two, now you're singing three, now you're doing the four. And we got it all worked out, and it's about a 20, 25-minute piece released on Turnabout. And Danny Kaye was supposed to be the narrator, because Alec was going to donate the funds to UNICEF. And came time for the recording, and we got the kids together, the wind ensemble together, and we did all the about 14 of the 16 tracks, leaving one blank for the narration. And Danny wasn't going to be able to make it, but he's going to do it later. So it was one of those records that came out. It never really happened, but we put it together like that. And Danny conked out in more ways than one. And so we said, "Now who's going to narrate it?" And Lou Ozer said, "It ought to be you, Alec. You've got a big rumbly voice." And Alec said, "Never." Well, One day we went down to Clark Gale House's place in Huntington Station, Long Island, and Alex said, I'll say it once and once only. There'll be no rehearsing, I'll just do it. So we went down with the master tape, and he recorded his narration. Well, it didn't quite fit, but it wasn't mixed yet. So my task was to take Alex's spoken words and gradually drive the engineer crazy, moving it around and putting it together. And we finally came up with this performance that never happened, but we published it on Vox anyway. And what I've done is edit out about 5 minutes worth, just the places where Alec is reading the words of these kids as a narrator.
How they feel about the world as they see it. They still play and laugh and misbehave, but they've begun to think of something that maybe children never thought about before, a peaceful world. They've heard of everything else, every frightening, monstrous thing but peace. So here they are to sing, to speak of peace in their own puzzle. Angry, innocent voices. Begging for, praying for, asking us, you and me, with solemn, loving voices for peace.
So peace.
I wish I could stop the war. I would drive an airplane and get all the men and boys and bring them back home. If we could take a lot of food and bring it over, that would be nice. If we made a shelter for you, you would not be hurt or killed. If we had peace, what would you do? Peace is very, very nice for the world. Don't you think that? Well, I do, and I hope you do, too. Before you could get the meaning of peace to the world, you yourself have to have peace of mind, which means you have to search your own mind to find answers to things that concern you. In other words, you must find yourself. Then you must help other people find themselves. Once enough people have found themselves, they can start trying to find the country which we have.